Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
It's unclear if a drone strike killed a Somali militant leader, and Ebola kills 31 in the DRC and threatens food security. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Officials are trying to determine whether a U.S. drone strike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Godane, the leader of militant group al-Shabaab. Somali officials say Monday's attack targeted senior al-Shabaab leaders who were meeting in the lower Shabelle region. Witnesses say the drone targeted three vehicles traveling on a road, two of which were hit by multiple missiles, while the third may have escaped. The Lower Shabelle's governor told VOA Somali service that the airstrike occurred between two towns about 70 kilometers north of Barraway, which is an al-Shabaab stronghold. The death toll from an Ebola outbreak in the Northern Democratic Republic of Congo has risen to 31. The country's health minister says officials have recorded a total of 53 confirmed and suspected cases of Ebola in a district of Equator Province. The outbreak is believed to be unrelated to the one in West Africa. Meanwhile, the United Nations says the outbreak has put harvests at risk and has sent regional food prices soaring. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization issued a warning today and a special alert for Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Southern African countries say they will send an envoy and an observer team to Lesotho following an apparent coup attempt over the weekend. Officials from the Southern African Development Community made the announcement during an emergency meeting in Pretoria Monday with Lesotho's prime minister and several other officials. This is VOA News. The human rights organization Amnesty International is accusing the Islamic State group of conducting a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing in northern Iraq. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
The report is based on interviews with survivors of massacres and other refugees who have fled to Kurdish-held areas, and some telephone calls with people trapped in areas controlled by the militants. Speaking via Skype from the Kurdish-controlled Iraqi city of Erbil, Amnesty's senior crisis response advisor Donatella Rovera told VOA the sweeping advance by Islamic State militants has changed the demographic map of northern Iraq in a horrifying way.
The Islamic State has been carrying out a very brutal campaign and has managed to remove, ethnically cleanse, the ethnic and religious minorities.
Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Pakistan's parliament has reassured the embattled Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif of its support against any extra constitutional attempt to dislodge him. Ayaz Ghul reports.
Parliament opened an emergency session to rally political support for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif as thousands of protesters continued their agitation just outside the building for a third week. Federal Minister Ehsan Iqbal later spoke to VOA to explain the importance of the meeting and the message it has sent to those protesting outside.
The parliament has today with one voice said that the red zone, the area of Islamabad where they are occupying, that should be gotten clear from these miscreants, and there will be no resignation of Prime Minister because the entire parliament stands united behind the Prime Minister.
Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A Ukrainian official said today that Russian troops have been spotted in 10 locations inside eastern Ukraine, including two major cities, as the United Nations Refugee Agency reported that the number of people displaced by the fighting in eastern Ukraine has doubled in just a month. A spokesman for Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council said Russian armed forces were continuing to concentrate soldiers and military hardware in six areas in the Donetsk region, including the city of Donetsk, and four areas in the Luhansk region, including the city of Luhansk. Halliburton has agreed to pay $1.1 billion to settle a portion of the claims arising from BP's Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010. The oil services giant said today that the settlement is pending court approval. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Part of these areas have been quarantined or there have been measures to restrict the movement of people and also the gathering of people. And because of this, they're unable to bring the goods back to the main urban markets. And also farmers aren't able to deliver their goods to other smaller markets, feeder markets. So this is having an impact on the whole supply chain.
That's FAO economist Jonathan Pound, who says Ebola is threatening food security in West Africa. Details coming up also in the news. Officials are trying to determine whether a U.S. drone strike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Godain, the leader of militant group Al-Shabaab. And Nigeria's military claims it successfully defended the northeastern town of Bama from a heavily armed assault by Boko Haram fighters. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, officials are trying to determine whether a U.S. drone strike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Godain, the leader of militant group Al-Shabaab. Somali officials say yesterday's attack targeted senior Al-Shabaab leaders meeting in the lower Shabelle region. Witnesses say the drone targeted three vehicles traveling on a road, two of which were hit by multiple missiles, while the third may have escaped. Lower Shabelle's governor, Abdul Qadir Mohammed Noor, told VOA that the airstrike occurred between the towns of Hawe and Sabali, about 70 kilometers north of Barawi, an Al-Shabaab stronghold. Noor, who's traveling in the area with African Union troops, said he saw lights followed by a ground-shaking explosion. Sources in the area say Al-Shabaab sealed off the vicinity soon after the attack. There has been no confirmation of casualties. A Pentagon spokesman said only that an operation against Al-Shabaab had taken place and that the United States is assessing the results. U.S. drone strikes have targeted Al-Shabaab officials in the past, including one in January that nearly hit Godain. The United States has offered up to $7 million for information leading to the capture of Godain, who has led Al-Shabaab since 2007. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization says more than 1 million Somalis are in need of humanitarian assistance, and at least 200,000 children under the age of 5 are acutely malnourished as drought hits southern and central Somalia. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The UN's Food and Nutrition Analysis Agency, FSNAU, warns that the humanitarian recovery and gains made 2 years ago may be lost as poor rains, a cycle of violence, and reduced aid assistance threaten the lives of millions of Somalis. Agency Chief Technical Advisor Daniel Mola says the people of southern and central Somalia need humanitarian assistance and livelihood support in the next 4 months as they wrestle with crop failure and conflict.
Our projection indicates that a combination of poor rainfall, increased cereal prices as a result of conflict, but also because we had a below average harvest last year, and then a poor harvest prospects this year. So we now have over 1 million people that are acutely food insecure and need urgent humanitarian assistance until the end of the year.
The report also says more than 43,000 Somali children are at risk of dying from hunger, and one in seven under 5 years are acutely malnourished. In 2011, the UN declared famine in some regions of Somalia after more than a quarter of a million Somalis, mostly children, died of hunger. Mola calls on aid agencies and the international community to respond now before the situation worsens.
Although there is no imminent risk of famine now, but we should remember that even back in 2010-2011, half of the people, an estimated 260,000 people, died before famine was declared in July 2011. So we don't have to wait. Donors and the humanitarian community do not need to wait to a famine declaration to start respond.
Since the last crisis, Somali insurgent group Al-Shabaab has lost ground in the face of a concerted military push by African Union troops and Somali government forces. In some cases, the group has blocked roads to towns it lost in an effort to cut off incoming supplies. On Saturday, AU and Somali forces launched an offensive to take more ground from the group in areas it controls, especially the port town of Barawe, the insurgents' last remaining financial hub and the route used to ship weapons. Late Monday, US forces carried out an airstrike targeting Al-Shabaab commanders in the Lower Shabelle region as part of the effort to weaken the group's capabilities. Security observers hope that this time around, humanitarian agencies will be able to access more areas than in 2011, when the militant group controlled much of south and central Somalia, making the work of aid workers more difficult. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN is warning that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is threatening food security. Food and Agricultural Organization economist Jonathan Pound says quarantine zones and restrictions on people's movements have led to panic buying, food shortages, and significant price hikes.
Well, first and foremost, this is a huge health concern internationally and also within the countries. However, because of the restrictions that have been imposed and implemented within the country and also across borders in terms of restrictions on the movement of people and also the gathering of large groups, this has had repercussions on the movement of goods. And obviously this will have negative implications for food security.
Pound says areas that grow the most food in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone are also areas where there is a high prevalence of Ebola.
Part of these areas have been quarantined or there have been measures to restrict the movement of people and also the gathering of people. And because of this, firstly, many traders fear infections. They won't go to areas where there's high incidence of Ebola. And because of this, they're unable to bring the goods back to the main urban markets. And also, farmers aren't able to deliver their goods to other smaller markets, feeder markets. So this is having an impact on the whole supply chain, from the farm to a smaller market and then to the main market.
The main harvest season for rice and maize is just 2 weeks away. There had been good rains this year, so crop yields were expected to be high. However, the fear of Ebola has caused labor shortages at the farms. Pound says food shortages will push prices even higher.
Because of these supply shortages, the prices of food have gone up rapidly since the beginning of August. For example, the price of cassava was reported to have increased by 150% within the first 2 weeks of August. The price increases are mainly the result of these supply shortages. However, there's also other factors that have affected prices in the market, and obviously these higher prices have a negative impact on households' access to food. Some other factors include the depreciation of the currency. Many of these countries are reliant on external food supplies, and when the currency depreciates, the cost of imported commodities goes up.
FAO has sent animal health experts to West Africa to help stop the spread of Ebola. The virus is often found in bush meat. Meanwhile, the World Food Programme plans to deliver over 65,000 tons of food to 1.3 million people in the countries affected by Ebola. The World Health Organization reports today there is no link between the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO calls the findings reassuring because it means the virus did not spread from West Africa to Equatorial Province in northwestern DRC. The death toll in the DRC has risen to 31. Officials have recorded 53 confirmed and suspected cases of Ebola so far. Meanwhile, in West Africa, there have been more than 3,000 cases of Ebola and over 1,500 deaths. The WHO says the fatality rate averages 51%. Most of the deaths, nearly 700, have occurred in Liberia. The outbreak continues to escalate. The WHO says over 40% of the cases have occurred over the past 3 weeks. Nigeria's military claims it successfully defended the northeastern town of Bama from a heavily armed assault by Boko Haram fighters yesterday. Army officials claim they killed about 70 rebels who assaulted in armored tanks and trucks. Bama in Borno State has a population of 250,000 and is about 60 kilometers north of Maiduguri. Borno is one of three northwestern states the government has placed under a state of emergency. Amnesty International estimates more than 4,000 Nigerians have died in 2014 as a result of the northern conflict. Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau has vowed to create a caliphate. He claims to be descendant from caliphs of early Nigerian history. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of Nigerians have fled vicious attacks by Boko Haram into Cameroon in the past 10 days. The UNHCR says the refugees fear for their lives because the attacks by the insurgents do not stop at the border. Some 200 tusks from elephants slain in Cameroon and Gabon have been intercepted at the Yaoundé Similan International Airport. They were bound for Asia, where high demand for ivory has sparked the illegal slaughter of elephants in Africa. Conservationists say almost 12,000 elephants have been killed in Central African countries since 2004. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon authorities say the tusk came from the southern part of the country near the border with Gabon, where elephant poaching has been rife. Wildlife official Isola Dipanda supervised the operation to seize the tusk at the airport after a tip-off from locals. He tells VOA that although the poachers escaped, all efforts are being made to find them. He says at least 94 elephants of all ages were killed in this particular incident. He says they have secured the tusk and will track down those responsible for these crimes against endangered wildlife. Gabon, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo are home to more than half of Africa's forest elephants, the smallest of the African species. Their tusks are highly valued for jewelry and other ivory products in Asian markets because of the quality of their tusk. Isola Dipanda says if the current wave of poaching continues, the extinction of the forest elephant may become a reality.
L'éléphant, c'est une espèce intégralement protégée.
He says despite international protections of elephants, unabated poaching could mean that these elephants will disappear from the earth within a half century. Among the organizations working in Cameroon to protect endangered species is the Glass Grape Ape Organization, LAGA. Its director, Israel-born Ofri Dori, says elephant populations have fallen by more than 60% in the region in the past decade. He says poachers are part of criminal networks that conspire with corrupt African and Asian officials in the black market trade.
We believe the network is even bigger, so investigation is going on right now in trying to uncover more and trying to find more members from this network. It's a far larger thing than just one individual. This kind of traffic is cross-border traffic, which means that the trade is well-developed.
In 2012, the World Wildlife Fund says more than 200 elephants were slaughtered in a single national park in Cameroon. In March 2013, 86 elephants, including 33 pregnant females, were killed in Chad. The World Conservation Society, the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, and the International Union for Nature Conservation have blamed rebel groups in Central Africa, such as the Lord's Resistance Army and the Sudanese Janjaweed, for fueling the illegal ivory trade. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Officials are trying to determine whether a U.S. drone strike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Godeen, the leader of militant group Al-Shabaab. The U.N. is warning that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is threatening food security. And Nigeria's military claims it successfully defended the northeastern town of Bama from a heavily armed assault by Boko Haram fighters. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. A new study says the pace and severity of climate change may overwhelm small-scale farmers in Africa. The study describes those farmers as the mainstay of food production on the continent. The findings were released at the African Green Revolution Forum in Addis Ababa. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The 2014 African Agriculture Status Report says small-scale farmers are already struggling to keep up with the effects of climate change. Dr. David Safo Amayau is managing editor of that report and director of strategy, monitoring, learning, and evaluation at AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa.
Small-scale farmers are the backbone of African agriculture. About 70% of the rural population in sub-Saharan Africa are small-scale farmers. They produce about 80% of the food need in Africa.
Small-scale farmers grow most of the staple crops in Africa on plots of land usually ranging from 2 to 10 hectares. They lag far behind farmers in many other countries in cereal production, with about 1.5 tons per hectare compared with over 5 tons elsewhere.
About 90% of these farms are rain-fed, which means that they depend on the weather. Whether it's rainfall, whether it's drought, whether it's increase in temperature, they are exposed to these climate effects than any other part of the world. On top of that, most of them use their own labor or family labor. They are not mechanized.
The AGRA report says farmers in sub-Saharan Africa are contending with an increase in average temperatures.
It is being projected that within the next 35 years, the increase in temperature will be between 1.5 to 2.5 degrees. This major rise in temperature brings a lot of issues to African food security. It is going to affect reduction in yield, which is already low, increase in vulnerability to pests and diseases that will kill most of the livestock.
Climate change is also expected to affect the average length of the growing season, which could reduce already low crop yields. Amayau says to mitigate the effects of climate change, African farmers are urged to adopt what's called climate-smart agriculture. It includes improved soil management.
We are talking about farmers being able to adapt both organic and inorganic nutrient-enriching technology to improve their soil fertility. Things that we promote are the right use of inorganic and organic fertilizer, soil tillage, the right use of cultivating the land, putting things like legume and cereals together to increase the soil nutrient content.
Another recommendation is the adoption of new crop varieties that rely less on manufactured fertilizers or have a higher tolerance for heat or drought. The Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa official says plant breeders are also increasing both the productivity and nutritional value of crops.
In AGRA, what we do is to be able to help African scientists. Currently, we have trained about 200 African crop breeders. We have been able to release over 400 African varieties. About 80% of these varieties have been commercialized. When I say commercialized, it means it has been multiplied by Africa seed companies.
The new varieties include maize, sweet potato, sorghum, soya, and cassava. Amayau says they are not genetically modified.
No. AGRA, as an organization, doesn't promote GMO. We are talking about conventional breeding to improve varieties that will be adopted by the farmers and that can be able to withstand the climate change that we are going through.
Amayau says despite climate change, there is enormous potential for smallholder-led agricultural growth. But, he adds, there is an urgent need to increase investment and expand climate-smart agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa. He estimates that would cost more than $1,600 per smallholder farmer each year for 10 years.
Through donors and other people, we will be able to invest about 10% of this amount. Governments will invest about 50%, and private sector will invest about 40% of this amount to transform African agriculture by 2020.
Investments, he says, are needed for such things as research and development, the training of scientists, reducing post-harvest waste through better processing, storage and transportation, and modern marketing techniques. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
South African countries say they will send an envoy and an observer team to Lesotho following an apparent coup attempt over the weekend. Officials from the South African Development Community, SADC, made the announcement during an emergency meeting in Pretoria yesterday with Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane and several other officials. During the talks, led by South African President Jacob Zuma, the participants agreed on a timeline to end the suspension of parliament, a key demand of rival parties. SADC Executive Secretary Stergo Mena-Lorenz-Stack told VOA the situation in Lesotho was unfortunate. She said the SADC is pushing the leaders to work together. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jane Psaki also stressed the need for political cooperation. She said in a statement late yesterday that multi-party democracy is important for Lesotho's political and economic development, and that any threat to that model would be a setback for the nation and the region. Prime Minister Thabane fled Lesotho on Saturday before the military surrounded his residence and that of a top police official and then disarmed two police stations in the capital, Maseru. Mr. Thabane accused the army and Deputy Prime Minister Motejoa Meseng of seeking to oust him from power.
Do you love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Thank you.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Officials are trying to determine whether a U.S. drone strike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Godane, the leader of the militant group Al-Shabaab. The U.N. is warning that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is threatening food security. And Nigeria's military claims it successfully defended the northeastern town of Bama from a heavily armed assault by Boko Haram fighters. Coming up, music from Liberia. In our feature segment, we focus on Ethiopia's growing reputation as a wine producer. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with African football.
Yehiz, joining us once again on The Voice of America from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening from Washington, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, the death toll from the Ebola outbreak in Africa continues to rise. What's the latest on Ebola and its impact on the upcoming 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers?
I'm going to look at it country by country, those affected. The first is Nigeria. Congo-Brazzaville, who are due to play in Nigeria, they wanted the match moved, but CAF have said no. There have been deaths in Nigeria, but thankfully very few, Sunny, and they're in the Lagos area mainly. And the match itself is in Calabar, which is hundreds of kilometers to the east of the Nigerian commercial capital. So that one is definitely on. And the other good news for the Super Eagles is that the South African authorities have said it is fine for the Nigerians to come and play in Cape Town. That's on match day two. So Nigeria's matches are definitely fine at this stage, home against Congo and away against South Africa. Guinea, Sunny, they've moved their home match against Togo to Casablanca in Morocco. That will be played this Friday. Now, Togo came out very strongly and said under no circumstance were they going to risk playing in Conakry. And I must say the Guineans moved quickly and professionally. I think they realized it wasn't going to happen in Conakry, and they got in touch with the Moroccan authorities and very quickly rearranged that fixture. But I always feel it's a little bit sad. It is a home match for Guinea. And normally they could look forward to about 30,000 people crammed into their national stadium. And that surely is worth something to the Guineans, but they won't have that advantage, unfortunately, in Casablanca. The other Guinean match against Uganda, there were some worries at the weekend on this one, Sunny. There was a feeling that the Ugandan health authorities were not going to allow the Guineans into the East African country. I was in touch with Kampala, and I have been assured by the Ugandan football authorities that as things stand, that match in Kampala, Uganda against Guinea, will go ahead. The next country, Sunny, is Sierra Leone, and here are the real problems. They've solved one of them, as far as I can understand. The match on September 10, that is a home fixture for Sierra Leone against the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, Sierra Leone officials say they contacted Morocco and Ghana but got no response. And now we've got a very unusual situation where the DR Congo have agreed to host the game in their second city, Lubumbashi. But what is very strange is the fact that DR Congo are the away team, but they're going to be playing on their own ground. It just shows you something how desperate the situation has become. Sierra Leone really battling to find a neutral venue for their home match, and they've now had to move it essentially to the ground of their opponents. So DR Congo, in effect, will have a home match, which is actually supposed to be an away fixture. An even bigger problem is the September 6th game against Ivory Coast and Abidjan. In fact, this one sticks out, Sunny, as the real problem as we enter into the week of the first qualifiers. The Ivorian government said under no circumstance will they allow the Sierra Leone team into the country to play in Abidjan, despite the fact that Sierra Leone have picked an all-foreign-based team. And I think that's a very good gesture from the Sierra Leones. And the coaches, who, of course, are based in Freetown in Sierra Leone, they have agreed to go through a number of Ebola screens and tests to make sure that they're 100% clear before they even leave Sierra Leone for Abidjan. But despite this, as we talk, Sonny, that match, there's a huge question mark over it. Because what CAF have said is that if you forfeit one game, you are disqualified from the competition. So if Ivory Coast forfeit this match at the weekend, essentially what CAF are saying is they're out of the competition. Now, that's a huge blow to the prestige and the status of the Africa Cup of Nations. I mean, Ivory Coast ranked second in Africa. They've been the favourites for the last five competitions. And I truly hope and I believe every African footballer and every African football fan is right behind me when I say this. I sincerely hope we can find a solution. That match has got to go ahead. Ivory Coast are an essential part of the Cup of Nations.
David, that match will go ahead this weekend in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. An update now for our VOA football fans. The Ivorian government relented on Tuesday and said Saturday's Nations Cup qualifier against Sierra Leone will be played as scheduled. Meanwhile, the Ivory Coast Football Federation says most of its top players, including Gervinho of AS Roma and three-time African Footballer of the Year Yaya Toure of Manchester City, have arrived in Abidjan to prepare for the match.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner at UA. VOA. And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Larry. My friend Larry Zamuje says sports radio Brilla FM has expanded in the past few years and also has stations in Kaduna in the north and Onitsha in the east. Now let's go to Spain, where it's the fourth day of competition at the FIBA Basketball World Cup. African champion Angola suffered its second consecutive loss Tuesday, falling to Mexico 79-55 in Las Palmas, Spain. Hector Hernandez had a game-high 24 points for the Mexicans, while center Valdelicio Joaquim led the Angolans with 13 points. The Angolans have dominated African men's basketball over the years, with 11 continental titles to their credit. Their best showing on the international stage came at the 2006 FIBA Basketball World Championship hosted by Japan, where they reached the knockout stages and finished 10th overall. With a record of 1 win and 2 losses, the Angolans will wrap up group play with games on Wednesday against Slovenia and Thursday against Australia. The two other African teams competing at the FIFA Basketball World Cup are Egypt and Senegal, and both will be back on the court Wednesday. The Egyptians have lost their first 3 games. They'll next play Iran, which is also winless, in Granada, Spain. Senegal, meanwhile, has been the big African surprise in Spain. The Senegalese, led by Minnesota Timberwolves center Gorgui Dieng, stunned Croatia on Monday, 77-75, perhaps the biggest upset in the tournament. Senegal, with 2 wins and 1 loss in Group B, will next play Argentina on Wednesday in Seville, Spain. Argentina also has 2 wins and 1 loss.
Hey, this is VOA's Downtown Brown. The FIBA Basketball World Cup just tipped off,
and ends with the final two games on September 13th and 14th. Send me your picks on who do you think is going to win medals and your reason why. And we'll try to give you a shout-out during Friday's Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC. You can also send me an email at dbrown@voanews.com. Or you can reach us at facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Visit our Twitter page at VOA Sunny Sports. And make sure you use the hashtag SunnyFIBA at the end of your comment. I'm VOA's Downtown Brown, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
The U.S. men's national soccer team returns to action Wednesday when it plays a friendly international match in the Czech Republic. The USA's German coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, says he plans to use the game in Prague as an opportunity to look at young talent. One of the young players Coach Klinsmann has called up for the friendly is 21-year-old striker Joe Jau, who plays for the reserve team of Borussia Dortmund in Germany's Bundesliga. Joe's father, Philip, also played professionally, and he's the head coach of the men's soccer team at Howard University here in Washington. And Philip recently appeared on Straight Talk Africa, hosted by my friend Shaka Sali, talked about the World Cup and other football-related topics. And let me give a shout-out for Joe Jau's grandfather, Joseph Nana Jau, who used to play for the Black Stars of Ghana. Meanwhile, Argentine star Lionel Messi will miss Wednesday's friendly international against World Cup champion Germany with a right leg injury. The match in Dusseldorf is a chance for Argentina to avenge a 1-0 loss to the Germans in extra time in the World Cup final, played almost 2 months ago in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Argentina versus Germany rematch. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a look at Ethiopia's growing reputation as a wine producer. And next, water and food security topics addressed at the African Green Revolution Forum. But first, some music. Here is Nimba Burr of Liberia with African Beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Come on and dance to the beat.
Dance to the beat.
Nimba Burr of Liberia with African Beat. Despite a global reputation for poverty, war, and famine, Ethiopia has become one of Africa's fastest-growing economies. With little help from the French beer, wine, and soft drink giant Castel, Ethiopia may become a major wine-growing region. Castel planted 750,000 vines in the nation's south 7 years ago and started bottling their African wine this year. Laurel Bowman talked to Castel's site manager, Oliver Spilbout, and has this report.
It might look like France, but these vineyards bursting with Merlot, Syrah, and Chardonnay grapes are actually in southern Ethiopia. But there is a French connection. The French beverage giant Castel bottled its first batch of Ethiopian wine this year.
Our target is really to propose this wine to the Ethiopian people and with good quality, good price, and so on.
Castel aims to sell half this year's production of 1.2 million bottles to the domestic market and half to Ethiopians living abroad. Meantime, the Ethiopian government hopes wine can boost its image abroad as it aims to attract more foreign investment and bolster an economy that's already growing at one of the fastest rates in Africa.
We have a vision. Ethiopia will have a hub for light industries, for labor-intensive light industries in Africa.
The sandy soil, short rainy season, cheap land, and abundant labor make Ethiopia ideal for wine growing. And there have been surprise buyers, including a Chinese businessman who purchased 22,000 bottles. In a region that can still conjure images of famine, poverty, and war, there are hopes wine can change the way outsiders view the country.
People are quite proud to see that French companies are bringing the best of their technology and knowledge to Ethiopia. So I really think the image of Ethiopia is changing very much.
Castel officials say their main concern is keeping up with demand. The company has plans to expand the vineyard soon. Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
The deserts of North Africa may be an unlikely place to search for water, but some of Africa's most surprising underground supplies have been found there. A recent study concluded that there is 100 times more water beneath the earth in Africa than what is available above ground. Water and food security are among the topics to be addressed at the African Green Revolution Forum in early September. Irun Gahutan is a senior policy advisor for the African Green Revolution Forum. He says participants will discuss how 300 million Africans can achieve access to this untapped resource.
What science has discovered over the last year or so is that there are a large number of underground water aquifers in Africa that have as yet not really been tapped. Something like 100 times what's available on the surface of the continent is now available under the continent. What's particularly interesting is that those resources actually can be found in North Africa, areas that are considered to be extremely desertified, short of water sources. Now, as we know, the potential for a continent like Africa is huge, huh? In the sense that something like a third of the continent, or 300 million people, do not have access to clean water, and only 5% of our arable land is currently irrigated. So the potential for this, not just for African agriculture, but even for exporting water, becomes really interesting.
When you say it's in North Africa, what country specifically?
Well, it's not just in North Africa. There's a high concentration in North Africa, but across the entire continent in different belts, there are huge underground water aquifers. Just to give you an example from an area that's very close to me here in Nairobi, Turkana, an area that is really known to be an arid area, has just discovered huge water aquifers that probably could service the entire country, just to give you a sense of the scale. But in terms of North Africa, it's countries like Libya and Morocco that have these large aquifers.
Have any of these aquifers been tapped?
Not sufficiently enough. I mean, what the study showed is that much of this water is completely untapped. The question, of course, now becomes whether we should have a large-scale tapping of these aquifers or whether we should really be looking at local community-based boreholes to basically tap this to ensure that we do not essentially squander this wonderful resource that we may have discovered. The classic corollary that we need to make is really with the large-scale land grabs or the large-scale land acquisitions, if you want to be more polite. But we've seen over the last 5 years, you know, tens of thousands of acres simply handed over to Indian, Middle Eastern and European companies, either to produce food crops for export or to produce biofuels. Many of those hectares are hectares that are productive, and in many cases, they will have access to water. So the danger is really we would see a repetition of this scramble for Africa's resources, this time for water.
Is there a specific example of an aquifer that has been tapped that is in use right now, an underground aquifer?
Current findings, you know, are essentially in addition to aquifers that we've known about. And so it's not only the case that they've not been tapped, but I don't have a ratio of what we're currently using in terms of underground water versus what has been found, except just simply to say that the amounts that are untapped are just huge. I mean, 100 times is the figure that they're using.
That was Irungu Houghton, Senior Policy Advisor for the African Green Revolution Forum. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Nairobi. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Nfunganye, and our engineer, Wycheck Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States does not recognize the legitimacy of the so-called presidential elections conducted in the Abkhazia region of Georgia on August 24th and will not acknowledge their outcome, said U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. The United States, along with the vast majority of nations, does not recognize the breakaway Georgian provinces of Abkhazia and South Ossetia as independent states. Russia, which fought a short war with Georgia in 2008 related to escalating tensions over the separatist region of South Ossetia, does, and thousands of Russian troops remain in the territories. At a State Department briefing, Ms. Psaki said the U.S. position on Abkhazia and South Ossetia remains clear. These regions are integral parts of Georgia. We once again urge Russia to fulfill all of its obligations under the 2008 ceasefire agreement, including withdrawal of its forces to pre-conflict positions, reversal of its recognition of the Georgian regions as independent states, and provision of free access for humanitarian assistance to these regions. In addition, State Department spokesperson Psaki said, "We renew our full support for the Geneva international discussions as a means to achieving concrete progress on security and humanitarian issues that continue to impact the communities on the ground in Georgia."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Imara mirundi warati nzeno